I'm Andrew O'Hagan, host of a new podcast from the London Review of Books. It's about the bloodiest and most controversial event of the Falklands War, the sinking of the General Belgrano. Margaret Thatcher was accused of a war crime. The truth would only emerge in the pages of a private diary. This is the Belgrano Diary. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to the London Review Bookshop podcast. To find out about our upcoming events, visit londonreviewbookshop.co.uk/events.
Hi, thank you for coming. If you can hear the air conditioning, I'm afraid that's just what it is, because otherwise we'd be boiling hot. But I just want to talk a little bit about the book and Shiromi and what's happened. So we're a small press. There's only 2.4 of us. The 0.4 works a little bit. The other two work some. I'm really happy that Shiromi's here with Owen and Olivia to kind of celebrate the book and talk about the work of Minette de Silva and just generally her life and the fiction that Shiromi's created around that. Essentially, like, Gary, who's sitting here, is also part of Influx Press. We had nothing to do with this book, really. Sanya Semakula, who's not here tonight, she picked it out of a pile, found it, polished it, and then gave it to us. And we said, yes, please. I'm here to take all the glory from Sanya. But were she here, she'd be doing the introduction. I think Shiromi's novel is a kind of a brilliant portrayal of a forgotten woman from history, an architect, a brilliant mind, and it needs to be celebrated. We'll talk more about Minette de Silva as it goes, but a tiny little bit of background before everyone launches in. She was an architect who qualified from AA just down the road, first Asian woman to be elected to REBA, Royal Institute of British Architects, left, set up her own practice in Sri Lanka, and kind of made her own way that way, faced many obstacles, as you might imagine, as a Asian woman architect in the 50s and 60s, of which Shiromi chronicles with a lyricism and an elegance that I don't think many other writers would have been able to achieve. She has written a book that celebrates someone but also shows their true character and doesn't shy away from nuance, but also explores the relationships Minette de Silva had with various rather powerful men, mostly European men, and that kind of interesting tension between sort of the great man figure of architecture and art against Minette de Silva's kind of more, unconventional occupation of the space in which those great men occupied is probably the crux of the book and really worth exploring, and also why we published it in the first place, to kind of re-establish Minette de Silva and her story into a kind of modern space. It is a book of fiction, however, so there are liberties, and it's not biographical, which I'm sure will be discussed on the panel. And, of course, it features quite heavily a guy called Le Corbusier, who you might have heard of. I don't know much about him. Anyway, just to introduce the panel, Owen Hatherley on your far right, but is definitely far left. Is the author of Militant Modernism and most recently The Adventures of Owen Hatherley in the Post-Soviet Space. Shiromi's in the middle, and Olivia Sucic, who is the author of Sympathy and an essay book called Exposure. So I guess this is the time to make a round of applause and introduce everyone else.
I can't clap because this will come
Thanks, Kit. That was at least half of my first question. I'm going to ask, start off with some, just talking about the sort of basic, what the book is about and so forth, then go on to some of the things it sort of brings up, and then we're going to read some of the not entirely factual letters that appear in the book. So the first obvious question I was going to be, who was Minette de Silver and why do we have to ask? Mm-hmm. But now I've been told who she was. So why do we have to ask?
Why do we have to ask who she is? I think there are a few things I do need to say about her that were not actually covered in Kit's introduction. So, you know, Minette, she studied at the AA just after the Second World War. And during her time in Europe, she came to know some very illustrious figures, among them Henri Cartier-Bresson, the Gielgud's, and, of course, Le Corbusier. And then she was called back to Sri Lanka. And you know, her relationship with Le Corbusier, you know, was one that was very much based on a long correspondence, and it was a friendship, which I imagine to have been something a bit more than that. But when she returned to Sri Lanka, she really kind of synthesized these ideas about modern architecture and saw that she needed to do something that was more relevant to Sri Lanka, or Ceylon as it was known then. And so she really was a pioneer. She was the first modernist architect of Sri Lanka. And apart from that, she also kind of came up with this idea of modern regionalism. So she was really trying to bridge the distance between modernism and the kind of regional architecture that you find in Sri Lanka. And that really wasn't a thing back then, but it really became a thing, which maybe you could talk a little bit more about. But I think, you know, that's one of the reasons why we do need to know about her, because she had this really pioneering vision about architecture, which has since really been, I'd say, buried and forgotten and eclipsed by the more famous architect of Sri Lanka, whose name I'm not even going to mention. This is not an event about him.
And why this particular sort of book about her? And so far as this is, you know, it's a sort of proper sort of complex historical novel. It's, you know, it's not sort of like, here is a recounting of her heroic life. You sort of take it in all kinds of peculiar directions. And sort of what were your sort of reasons for that? And how free did you feel that you could be with the record?
Gosh. So my reasons for it being more than just the relationship between Le Corbusier and Minette are simply because they lived during a very particular time. This is, you know, the post-colonial period. Ceylon had just become independent. And I felt like they just coincidentally happened to be practicing at a time when these countries were engaged in, you know, building their new nations. And there's a lot to be kind of dissected in that. So I always set out to write about that period. And then you asked me, I've forgotten what the second part of your question was.
More about the kind of fact and fiction aspect. And so far as so much of the book hinges on the letters exchanged.
Yes, exactly.
I mean, obviously letters were exchanged between Minette de Silver and Le Corbusier.
Yeah, they were.
But they weren't necessarily these letters.
No, they really weren't. they really weren't. They're very much a fiction. I kind of like blanked that question, right? Because I've been people ask me that question a lot, and I would, you know, I used fact as my basis. I did actually go to the Fondation Le Corbusier to read Minette's letters, because those are really the only letters that I really had access to. I had some access to his as well, because she created this autobiography, which is like a scrapbook, and it has a few examples of his letters, carefully curated. So, you know, you really have to read between the lines there. How free did I feel? Well, because it was a work of fiction, I assumed the freedom that a creative writer should always have. But I also felt like, you know, I needed to maintain a certain credibility around these characters, particularly Le Corbusier and Minette. And therefore, I kind of rooted it in particular milestones in their lives and in their work. But other than that, you know, because it's a novel, you know, you do have to kind of, you need to have some freedom so that you actually create the kind of dynamics in a novel to create, you know, that story arc. Mm. And so I took that freedom.
But there's people in there who sort of, you know, the names obviously aren't changed, such as
Marsha. You know,
yeah, exactly.
Marsha,
and obviously mainly Minette de Silver and Le Corbusier. But also there are people where sort of knowing a little bit about the history, I was able to kind of go, oh, I know that. Yeah. I know who that is. That's Maxwell Fry and Jane Drew, but not named as such.
No.
And then there's obviously the architect who we're not naming.
No. Who shall not be named.
Who I think is, you know, sort of, by now I think it's quite widely accepted, took some of her ideas and was much more successful with them.
Yes. Yes. He did. And I mean, I do explore a bit of that in the novel, actually. And actually, in reality, he did really respect her work. And I believe he spent some time in one of her houses, and that was one of his favorite houses in Colombo. So I can't completely villainize him, but it is true, and it's actually not his fault. Mm. You know, he borrowed those ideas via a certain someone who worked for her and then defected.
That the Dane.
Yes, the Dane. Defected. That's Ulrich Plesner, actually.
But it sounds a little bit to me like that links into your first question about why do we need to know who we already know? And it may not be he who shall not be named's fault. It's the reception where I think there's this tendency definitely with modernist architecture, and Denise Scott Brown talks about this tendency to want to appoint one lone male genius figure. And obviously the way that architecture works, like most art forms, is much more collaborative than that. Mm-hmm. But it's a lot easier for the people who write the, you know, pieces of criticism, mm-hmm. etc., to want to pin things to one lone individual. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you were saying earlier when we were downstairs that he was a bit of a recluse, so mm-hmm. I can't imagine he was going around sort of socializing and networking and, like, saying it was his idea. But you can imagine how that would then become the story that the press wants to, you know, run with more.
I would say, I mean, I'd agree with you that actually, you know, subsequent, I guess, writers and critics on of architecture did really kind of seize on him. But also, I think because he was situated in Colombo and he's a man, you know, people just automatically gave him a certain degree of credibility and just forgot about her. And she was located outside of the capital. She was in Kandy, which is the hill town of Sri Lanka. And so, you know, that also might have fed into it, but I do think there was a gendered element, dimension to all of that. Yeah.
But also so many of the kind of the sort of successful female architects of that era, frequently sort of husband and wife teams. I mean, there's, you know, Richard and Elizabeth and this, but there's, you know, sort of Alison and Peter Smithson, Shimon and Helena Circus, all these are people that, you know, were very much, sort of, that you could become prominent. Obviously, Denise Scott Brown being a spectacular example of that. Like, you know, awards tending to go to Robert Venturi, even for buildings by Denise Scott Brown.
Yeah. And refusing to award awards to more than one person,
yeah,
or
precisely.
Like bring wives to anything. And it's like, what? But I'm not a wife, I'm an architect.
Yeah, exactly. So but we're dealing here with someone that was very much solo and very much kind of constructed a particular sort of identity around her. So you mentioned there's a lot in there of sort of people looking at her you know, with her with her saris and with her flowers and so forth, and with her particular look that she's worked out.
Yes,
and
it's her brand.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Can you talk a bit about how she sort of constructs that particular brand?
So, I mean, she's just so ahead of her time on every level. So she constructed, as I've always said, it's this brand. She's in these fabulous saris with flower in her hair, and it's totally deliberate because she knows that people are already exoticizing her. for the way she looks, because she's an Asian woman from the Orient. And, you know, empire has not kind of, it wasn't long dead at this stage, right? So all of those ideas and beliefs are kind of still percolating. And she, when she came to London, in that post-war period, everything was really kind of, you know, gray and drab. And there she was, like this, Le Corbusier called him his oiseau de paradis, you know, because she was this really sort of elegant and extravagant figure against this very drab backdrop.
Okay,
and
she... Bridgewater.
Yes, and she, yeah. Anyway, and she kind of just capitalized on that and exploited that. But at the same time, she was subverting the whole notion of the pliant, you know, Asian female, because she was working in a man's world, and she never kind of shied away from trying to pursue her ambition. So, so she was treading this really interesting line, I think, and just used whatever she had in order to get ahead. And I don't mean that in a kind of horrible sort of cutthroat way. I mean it in a very clever way.
She's taking ownership of something that she knew was already going to be
exactly
used. Yeah. And I think her sort of biography scrapbook is called, you know, the life of an Asian woman architect.
Exactly.
So she's, you know, she's like, well, if they're going to call me that, yeah, I might as well make it my own brand.
It. Yeah, exactly.
There's also a question about the particular architecture that she does, and how that sort of brought out, sort of as the book goes on, of her sort of engaging with Le Corbusier, and in the letter sort of deferring to, you know, the great,
yes,
genius and so forth, but being very much, I'm going to go and do this, which is not necessarily the same thing.
Yeah.
And I'm sort of interested in how that sort of gradually brought out, and how her architectural ideas take more and more of a central role as it goes on.
Yeah, I mean, she starts out, as you say, she's really deferring to his genius, and she's all slightly, I'm not saying she's totally putting it on, but she is sort of flattering him, because he's a great man of architecture. But she has her own ideas, and she doesn't shy away from articulating them. And really secretly, she feels very much on par with him. You know, she is an equal. She is there. She has her ideas, and she believes in them. And she does not shy away from expressing them to him. But, you know, I think in the way that she sort of talks about it is maybe, you know, couched in all of this language of flattery. Oh, you're such a genius, and da-da-da. And there are, I mean, admittedly, there are times when she does feel like, you know, she lacks confidence, and that's because it starts out at the beginning of her career, and, you know, he's at the height of his career. She's just started, you know, she's just graduated, so she's just starting out with clients who are actually friends of her family, so it's not quite the same, you know, it's not the same level, right? So she does feel a bit unconfident, but as she progresses, as he also respects her ideas, and he does say, you know, quite nice things about what she's doing.
Yes.
So I think these two things kind of help her and bolster her. But as I say, she does have a will of iron, and she is really, I think she 100% believes in what she's doing, and she knows that she knows more about this subject than he does. I mean, for goodness sake, he calls him his oiseau de l'Inde, and she's not from India, you know, which is something that happens to Sri Lankans. I think there are a few in the audience, you'll know. But anyway, yes.
Actually, while you were talking, I found a little bit, which I know we're going to later read the letters, but there's a tiny quote in one of the letters you write where that you can see her confidence is, like, coming on, and she's also... she's almost doing that thing that I'm sure many successful women in architectural partnerships do, where they make it sound like it was their idea.
Yeah.
Where she says, "For me, the answer is to start with a series of questionnaires. It seems to me that rather than force a person to live a certain way, we should listen to their needs and try to serve those needs, all the while introducing small innovations that coax the individual towards a more harmonious way of living." I'm sure you agree, which just sounds like a... I mean, I'm sure obviously that was partly, you know, you investing that character, but with that sense of, like, flattery, but at the same time,
exactly,
like, showing quite an iron will beneath it.
Exactly. Nicely found.
I was so intrigued by the characterization of Le Corbusier himself, who it's extremely easy to demonize.
I know.
And he comes across as a prick, but quite sympathetic, as well as being
a sympathetic prick.
You know, he does, at the same time as saying all this pompous nonsense, he does listen to her.
Yes.
And she does take his architecture seriously. Yes. And there is this kind of, you know, it's a huge power dynamic, but it is two-way.
Yes.
And I was sort of, you know, that you get these sort of moments where he's having these huge pompous flights of fantasy, and then suddenly goes, I have been a shit. And just those little things I liked a lot. But I suppose, you know, the thing that he's doing throughout is, well, not throughout, but for a lot of the book, is he's designing Chandigarh. So he's sort of, you know, he's in northern India, you know, designing an entire capital city and getting enormously upset if there are lily pads in the ponds. and that seems such a huge contrast with how she's working on the houses at the same time.
Exactly. I mean, again, it's like, this is also about the male ego and his ego, his enormous ego. And of course, again, because he is already this great man of architecture, so of course one must listen to me because I am Le Corbusier, and if I declare that, you know, the ponds should be like mirrors, then you must listen. And so that I wanted to contrast that with her own kind of journey through her own architectural thinking. And she you know, she had a more participatory approach to her architecture. She also really wanted to consider the context, you know, the landscape, all of those things. So, yeah, I mean, those all of it is quite deliberate, and I wanted to set this kind of counterpoint there.
There's a really nice moment that comes in actually towards the beginning and the end where she's designed, is it the Aryapala Lodge. And she goes into the kitchen to see how it's all working, and she's designed it using the modular, you know, but all the, obviously the modular is based on a French man.
Yes.
A very tall one.
And so all the quite small Sri Lankan ladies are standing on stools to make all the food and to do all the washing up.
Yes.
And they're like, it's fine, we don't mind. Yes. But they have to just constantly use stools to do anything in the kitchen. And she's like, oh, God.
Exactly. Exactly. It's like a real kind of moment of awakening. And
Maybe her own instincts are sometimes better than his in that case.
Exactly. Yeah. And again, it's such an egotistical thing, isn't it? The whole idea of the modular, you know, being based on this massive male and then, you know, building a house to just accommodate that particular individual, or building a building to accommodate that individual.
The white male as the standard.
Absolutely.
And that being perfection. I mean, it's literally, that's how he describes it.
Absolutely. And then there's that moment where he goes to the governor's house in Delhi, and he's like, it's beautiful. It's not the modular. It's beautiful. But oh well, never mind. You know, but it pierces his ego, but not for very long.
There's another question before we sort of go to the letters about the political change that's happening. You know, and who are the actors within it? And in a way, there's a sort of point where she becomes a little bit less sympathetic, where you're sort of getting a lot of the time sort of the perspective from, you know, other people working in the house. You know, you get this sort of sense of where she is the elite.
Yes.
And there's this sort of enormous political change happening in both where Le Corbusier is working in India, but also in Sri Lanka. And you have the sense of, you know, on the one hand, Le Corbusier is kind of like, no one understands this apart from Nehru. Everyone else is a credit.
Yes.
And then you have her in this kind of moment of, you know, quite sort of revolutionary change as part of the English-speaking elite, who, as time goes on, is sort of finding herself being dispossessed and doesn't seem to like it.
Yes, yes. I mean, so this is very much... I was very mindful that she was, and that she did belong to an elite. You know, she belonged to the intelligentsia, even though she came from, to be fair, on her parents... Her parents, actually, her dad was actually from a very modest background and experienced discrimination and all sorts of things. So that fed into her politics, which made her more sympathetic. However, you know, she was what she was, and she was definitely an elite. And I wanted to kind of contrast that and actually take people out of her perspective, and I guess, lumped them into the perspective, say, for instance, of Jaya, the housemaid, so that you really got another view of who she was. Because there are kind of layers of hierarchy, and I absolutely wanted to explore that and give voice to, you know, the to other people, you know, to the to I guess the vast majority of people who make up Sri Lanka. So that was, you know, that was my kind of intention, but also to show just how these political elites, or rather this segment of society, because I have a certain view, but I can also, in the way that I present these kind of opposing forces, I can see, you know, why certain people thought the way they did about Sinhala only, for instance, the vernacular, and championing the vernacular as opposed to this colonial language, which is English.
And it sort of splits her friends straight down the middle. You know, her sort of particular scene of sort of painters and artists and so forth are completely kind of divided by this.
Yes, exactly. I mean, they go from being this kind of, you know, oh, we're artists and we are above, you know, the politics, to politics just really taking over. And you know, she, for a while, can remain aloof from the impact of all of these political changes because she's an elite. But eventually, it enters her own circle of friends, and it kind of tears them apart, really.
So we should start with one of the earlier of the letters.
Yes. So I am going to read a very short letter from the beginning of the book. Let's see if I've done my job and actually put a bookmark where it belongs. Yes. So this is right at the beginning. So the way the book is structured, so it has a very particular structure, is bookmarked by letters, the letters that Minette sends to Korb and vice versa. So this is right at the beginning of the book. Minette is still in London, and she's in that kind of honeymoon stage of being totally in love with, you know, Le Corbusier. So it's... she's reminiscing about the moment or the moments leading up to the time that she actually meets Korb. And just to say, this is slightly fictional because she actually met him in Paris before Bridgewater. But, you know, creative writing and all that. So it's 4th of June, 1949. She's in London. I'm having tea from one of my finest china cups. This is not, in and of itself, worth writing about, but there is something about the colour of this tea that makes me think of Bridgewater. The tea is not as bad as it was there, goodness no. In fact, it's rather good. I like my tea the Ceylon way. Plenty of milk and sugar with a shot of the best brewed BOP leaves to be found, those grown as high as possible in the hills. I remember thinking this at Bridgewater. I was taking a break between talks, wondering whether I would ever get a chance to speak to you. I'll be honest, Corbu, I was desperate to speak with you. I wanted to impress you somehow, to make you notice me, the architecture student from the East. I wanted you to train those rounded specs on me, to look at me, to see me. You were preoccupied. A fissure had opened up between the young and old architects. They were attacking you, Gropius, and the Athens Charter with its absolute separation of functions within a city. Who could deny the unique and radical needs of post-war urbanism? Who could still believe that a site was a blank slate upon which a plan and its architecture could be imposed? I have always wondered at the arrogance of supposing a place has no existence without a building installed according to a man-made plan. Sigiriya in Ceylon is exactly the opposite. It started with an enormous rock into which King Kashyapa carved himself and his entourage. It is the rock that stands out. The fortress, for indeed that is what it became, is barely visible, hinted at only in contours from afar. Its monumentality is drawn from its natural state. Closer inspection finds intricate claws and a staircase disappearing into the suggestion of a creature's gaping jaws, but all of this is hidden until you're close enough to touch it. The fortress was an island unto itself. Buddhist monks had once used it as an escape from this material world. Kashyapa came to it to escape certain death at the hands of his brother for killing their father. The fortress was always there, inherent in the rock, much as Michelangelo would find his sculptures buried in marble. People were milling about, sipping cups of tea and nibbling on hard biscuits. I was stirring 2 spoonfuls of sugar into my tea, absorbed by the vortex of liquid swilling about in my cup. I heard nothing but the ting of the spoon on bone china. Even that sounded so much like home that the air cooled around me. If I looked out, I thought, I would see green hills and a lake below, and creepers of carnelian flowers, and Amma would be behind me talking to Jaya, our housemaid, about the intricacies of making love cake. Papa would be sitting on the veranda next to them, offering his opinion on the ratio of kaju to semolina. I turned around. I felt you behind me, Corbu. I turned around to smile at you, to say finally, no, I had much more to say than that. Sigiriya. I was going to tell you about Sigiriya, Kashyapa, Michelangelo, about Marg, the magazine Otto, Marcia, and I founded in Bombay. I was going to ask you about Poissy and La Ville Radieuse. And all the while, I would watch you watching me, my hair, my necklace, my sari. I was ready, holding all this on my tongue as I turned around. There was no one there. The crowds had been winnowed to a scattered few, most engrossed in writing notes or brushing crumbs from their lapels. I turned back to my tea and drank. It was weak and cold. I considered the ratio of kaju to semolina alongside my imagined parents and Jaya, and somehow made light of my disappointment.
So the passage I'm going to read is sort of Le Corbusier, but my part when it's actually in the book, you sort of have him thinking about what he's going to write and then writing about it, and I'm just going to read the actual, the sort of bit in italics that he actually does send. And it's kind of, one of the things I like about it is he partly understands what she's doing.
Yes.
And partly doesn't.
No.
So this work you're doing on the Aria Parla House, Wasso, it fits perfectly the theme of the exhibitions. Here you are using the decorative arts in a functional manner and in a context removed from Europe. It would be useful to shift focus a little from the Western world, no? To look at modern architecture in the context of the Orient. Lessons of adaptation, integration of traditional methods so that new and old coexist, as you so eloquently put it. This old Corbu would like to see you, mon gentil Wasso. You have taught me so much about Le Inde. Your precise descriptions of those extraordinary sculptures at the Royal Academy. The Indians knew how to translate the human figure in all its robust tumescence. And these are your gods and goddesses, caught in fervent embraces, murderous bloodlettings or ecstatic dances. What then is left for mere mortals? Because we too must feed our appetites. To the Victorians, these figures were depraved. To us, they are aspirational. They show us what lies at the extreme ends of the possible. And what is possible for us? We too are moving towards this extremity. Never are we more alive than when we caper on its tip. In your attic flat in London, we discovered what it means to blunder onto this edge. You with tender fingers and eyes of fire, your wings beating against my heart. This old man does not deserve to find such vitality late in life. So I'm going to skip a bit because I said I don't hog too much of it, because he goes on, as you can imagine. You are a force in Ceylon now, Minette. You are bringing modernism to that nation and with it, progress. It is a fledgling country ready, like India, to embrace something new. How different it must feel to be in a place that has, as you once put it, become itself again. What is it like, Minette? The realms of possibility must be infinite. A newfound confidence, the courage that comes of success. Imagine, here is a chance to start again, build anew, reshape society and manners. Everywhere people are shedding the binds of war and demanding a better way of life. We can give this to them. We are pioneers, Minette. You even more so. Ceylon is ripe, ready to throw off the memory of colonization, or those British buildings signifying British power. Why keep those relics when the country rejects what they stand for? Better to knock them down and begin afresh. Better to create a new building vocabulary, as you are doing, rooted in pre-colonial tradition, but firmly modern in its outlook. This is your mandate as an architect of the modern age. Do not forget what you are. Maintenant, écoutez-moi, Minette. Pay no attention to these Aryapalas and their petty complaints. You must believe in your vision so completely that they bend to it. They will. We are the visionaries. Tell them this. Why else have they asked you to build the house? Because they do not know how to create as you do, that's why. So you do not listen to them. Listen to me. Listen to Corbu. And to yourself.
And I've chosen a letter from the end, luckily with a few less French pronunciations than that, where she's in Candy and Corbu is getting increasingly, I think, almost melancholic and concerned with age, and she's also now looking after her elderly father, and it's got a slightly more elegiac tone than some of their kind of cheekier earlier exchanges. And also I should mention that when she talks about her toes, it's because I don't know if this is true, but you've given him a bit of a foot fetish in this, where the first time he kind of encounters Minette de Silva, he's like looking at her feet and like her brown toes.
Yes. So
that in this letter that he's just written to her that she's responding to has become the kind of source of all his inspiration. Oh, and it's 1964. Congratulations, Corbu. Chandigarh is magnificent, and as you know, we have included it in Marg. Extraordinary. How fortunate that it was completed before Nehru's death a few weeks later. But Chandigarh has changed so since I was there. It is another world altogether. I feel honoured to have been a part of it, even if that contribution was ambiguous, unquantifiable. We are both there in its sinews. But you flatter me. To insist that Chandigarh sprouted from my toes. Unbelievable, Corbu. You are a romantic. No doubt you'll have changed your mind since you wrote that. It is only that you feel you owe me something that you project such importance upon me. I had no such natural wisdom, only the giddiness that youth brings and the blind faith of the starstruck. I'm not surprised that you feel somewhat bereft now that Chandigarh is complete. As you say, the feeling is inevitable, a postpartum depression that passes with acceptance. You must be relieved, too. No more travelling back and forth to India, no more disappointments and irritations to bluster over. In India, I mean. The others will continue to be there, I suppose. Above all, you must be very proud, Corbu. A member of the Legion of Honour. This is something I would have expected for you, but still, the reality of it must be so strange. I'm not surprised you feel unworthy, though you deserve it more than most. I'm sure you will miss your team more than you let on, Elizabeth in particular. She was such a feisty foil to you. In the beginning, the two of you were quite the pair. I think her observations must have been invaluable. It is always important, vital, I should say, to have someone you can trust to tell you the truth. As for Sitaram and Trivedi, I think their philosophizing was something you learnt a great deal from. They were, from my recollection, thoroughly trustworthy and serious types. Types you could leave your life's work with without fear of it being exploited or cheapened in some way. No, if it was the wisdom of civilizations that you needed when tackling Chandigarh, then it was them and not I who shared it with you. I went to Jaipur for the last time in June, so I think I just missed you, Corbu. What a shame. It would have meant a lot to me to be there at the inauguration of your life's masterpiece, as you call it. My research continues. I've enclosed a comparative essay on the architecture of South and Southeast Asia. Let me know what you think. I'm just going to skip over the middle bit where she's talking about looking after her father to end with, no, I'm not going anywhere. I've been here long enough. I'm making my mark as an architect. It will only be a matter of time before they recognize what I have achieved here. And when they do, I should be within awarding distance, should I not? And yet this country has gone from bad to worse. Do I really want to live in a place where states of emergency are as common and predictable as the seasonal monsoons? I continue to ask myself the question. Perhaps a few months from now, the answer will be clearer. Many congratulations to you, Corbu, your friend Minette.
Thanks. So we have about 10, 15 minutes for questions. So there is a mic, I think, going round.
So. Is it strange to hear other people reading a book?
It's actually quite nice. I feel it's very relaxing to hear.
Oh, that's good. And
it's interesting to hear how you interpret the text as well. So I'm relieved. Oh, someone's leaving.
Unless I got it wrong.
No, not at all. Not
so
at all.
Thank you for that. That was fascinating. I look forward to reading this book and giving it to my
husband.
So thank you for writing this book. It was fascinating, and I'm looking forward to reading it and handing it on to my daughter and son-in-law. Greatly enjoy this. I want to ask you, what is your background, and why did you choose Minette, and what is the reason for the title of the book?
So by background, do you mean, am I an architect? No, I'm not an architect. I'm not a specialist. I'm a writer, but I also work in another field as well, as a writer, but nonfiction. Why the title of the book? That's another question that a lot of people asked me. So plastic emotions, and I often say to people I'd like to hear what they think of the title and why they think I might have chosen it, because I feel like that's a thing that you often reflect on as a reader. But I'll give you my version anyway. I took that phrase from Le Corbusier's Towards a New Architecture, and he was describing architectural space as poetic space, and also as something, you know, plastic. And by plastic, we don't mean like, you know, plastic bags. It's like, it's something that can be molded, right? So the space is molding your emotion, and in this, or the poetry of that space is molded by the actual structure. I'm sure Owen will have better explanation for that. This is just my understanding. And so I felt like the structure of this novel is somehow there, and the structure of their correspondence kind of molds how they interact with each other. But there's also the wider kind of structure of the kind of political situation as well, which is molding the relationships and the dynamics between people in the novel. And so I felt like that was, even though it was Le Corbusier's words, I felt it was the right phrase for the book. But I would, that's just my version, and I think other people, when they read the book, will have their own interpretation.
I think this is such an important project that you've been researching, especially from your idea of the kind of narrative that you're following. But the architect that you're not naming, Jeffrey Bauer, I think is really doing a disservice, because he was born on the 23rd of July, today, 100 years ago. So I think we should all actually acknowledge the fact he's only one of other two architects from Sri Lanka that we should actually see. They both studied at the Architecture Association. Mm. He was influenced by Maxwell Fry, by Jane Drew. I think when we talk about these kind of issues in a fictional sense, of course, Corbusier was so influential, but both of them were interested in what Kenneth Frampton would talk about, a critical regionalism. And I think it's really important to think about local materials, the way that they both were interested in craft. And so for us, I think it's important to name him, because it's so few people that we know from that part of the world. So I just wanted to bring that into the equation.
Hi. Can I ask if her architecture still survives in Sri Lanka and elsewhere? And are there any books about her architecture which show photographs of it?
So the main book about her architecture is actually her autobiography, which is The Life and Work of an Asian Woman Architect, and it's out of print, which is a shame. There are a number of academics who are working to kind of recover her as an architect, and I'm hoping that like their work will come out soon. There is an academic called Anuradha Iyer, who is doing some work on the archive, for instance. Whether her buildings actually survive, yes. There are some, but not that many. And they're mostly in a pitiful state, those that do actually still survive. There are some in Colombo. The Aryapala House, which is actually the Karunaratna House, that was her first build, and that was in Kandy. That's actually the only build that I kind of changed the name of, because I wasn't necessarily that kind about the actual client, so I felt a little bit uncomfortable. Anyway, so the Karunaratna House is still standing. So that's her first build in Kandy, and then her first build in Colombo is also still there, Pyrrhus House 1. But they both really need kind of restoration. And then there are other builds, the Kandy Art Center, but it doesn't look really much like it was originally designed as. So, yeah, I mean, unfortunately, there isn't, unlike with Jeffrey Bauer, who actually set up a trust and his buildings are kind of being kept alive by this trust and being looked after. She didn't have a trust of any sort, and there isn't really any move to kind of restore or you know, maintain or protect her buildings. So quite a few of them have actually been destroyed. Yeah.
And from the little that I know, because they're often very much open to the elements as like, yes, a central feature of the design, yes, in terms of how quickly they are overtaken by the overgrowth.
The elements, yes,
you know,
exactly.
It's probably quicker than most.
Yeah, exactly.
I look forward to reading the book because I've actually met Minette.
Oh, fantastic.
Yes, she was quite old at the time. And I've been to a number of her houses as well.
Fabulous.
In the past, yes. So look forward to that. But why, what made you choose Minette to write about?
Well, I thought she was a kind of astonishing figure. And not many people knew about her. I certainly didn't know anything about her. I just heard about her from someone who worked with her. And I heard all these kind of fantastic stories about the people she knew. That's kind of how I first came to be impressed, which is a bit sad. But at the same time, it was a bit extraordinary to think that she had been, you know, socializing with some of the greats of, you know, 20th century. And she's this woman from Sri Lanka, and I'd never heard of her. So that just led me to kind of do a bit more research on her and find out more about her. And then that then led to my thinking, actually, I think more people would want to know about her. And so I wrote the book. It took me a very long time. But yeah.
And it's great.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The letters are 100%
The letters in the book are not. They're fictional. Yeah, yeah. I mean, I had to fictionalize what was actually there. But it's actually quite interesting because the letters that I saw did not actually cover, you know, the politics in the country. And I wanted to talk about the politics, and so that was injected into the letters, and I felt like that's a key thing that she would have been thinking about. And just recently, a friend of mine, the friend who was actually working with her, he sent me a letter that she'd written to him, and it was about politics, and it was so close to what I'd actually written that I was really astonished. And I thought, oh, I must have channeled something when I was writing this. So there was a bit of fact in them here and there, but most of it is fiction. Yeah.
Minette's father was the foremost politician in
Kenya. Yes. Yes, he really rose from his humble origins.
Isn't her Kandy, which is a Kandy Art Center, where,
yes,
she is, there's like a plaque,
yes,
but it's like daughter of so-and-so,
yes,
sister of,
exactly,
so-and-so, and she is an architect kind,
exactly,
of thing at the end.
Exactly. Really disappointing that.
Well, thank you for writing this story. I'm really looking forward to read the book.
Oh,
I had a question. So you've been describing her approach about, in contrast to Le Corbusier, about she understanding the space that has been built, the ideas that don't come from me, they come from kind of an ecology or something like that. I'm describing it quite bad, but, you know, it's not a tabula rasa. There's something,
that's
there,
right,
already, etc.
Yes.
But then when you're talking, when you're reading the letters, it's usually me, my design, my idea, my approach. And I'm wondering to what extent, in the real or in the fiction, do you describe in the book if she was approaching, you know, her designs, acknowledging the people that work in her studio, probably, the people that work on site, the,
yes,
people that... Well, if you could talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, I mean, actually, she had this kind of... So the craftspeople and the artist, these were... She felt like the perfect kind of trinity when you're designing and building was to have your architect, your fine artist, and your craftsperson. And so she worked with craftspeople to, you know, build the kind of decorative aspects of her buildings. So she had a kind of relationship with them, and they really did, you know, they respected her. And she was really, she wanted to kind of revive the kind of arts and crafts because she felt like this was a dying tradition in Sri Lanka. And it was kind of continuing in some ways the work that her mum had already been doing with the craftspeople. And they were kind of, as I said, a kind of dying tradition, and also they weren't really, you know, earning much because they weren't really given much kind of work. And I guess through her work and through her attempts to revive that, I feel like that must have also played into subsequent, you know, uses of the arts and crafts in building in Sri Lanka, because now it really is like intrinsic to the really nice architecture that you find in Sri Lanka today. So yeah, she really did, you know, she really respected these workers and wanted to kind of ensure that their livelihoods were also kind of protected.
That looked like it was the last one.
I think so, thank you.
We can stick around a bit and buy the book, obviously, and before we do that, please thank Shremi Pinto, Owen Heatherly, and Olivia Sudge. Thank you so much, everybody. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. To find out more about London Review Bookshop events, visit londonreviewbookshop.co.uk/events.
It's the Kia Summer Sticker Sales Event, so give your friends something to look at. Like a B&B with an ocean view, an endless field of wildflowers, or a sunset that needs no filter. Make this a summer to share and save with a capable Kia SUV or powerful sedan. See your local Kia dealer or visit Kia.com to learn more. Kia, movement that inspires.
Call 800-334-KIA for details. Always drive safely. Sale applies to purchase of specially tagged 2024 vehicles only. Quantities are limited. Must take delivery by 7/8/24.